This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, May 30th, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Bishop and Lowell. In 2008, Forrest Rouse and Giroux published Words in Air, the complete correspondence between Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell. In 2012, the playwright Sarah Ruhl arranged bits and pieces and some longer passages from their letters, along with some of their poems, into a play called Dear Elizabeth. It premiered at the Yale Repertory Theater and is now being staged by the Berkeley Rep through July 7th. If you go to the theater, you're likely to know who Sarah Ruhl is. Her productions include The Passion Play and In the Next Room or The Vibrator Play. 50 years from now, if people are still going to the theater, I think they probably will be, they will likely be seeing many repertory productions of Sarah Ruhl's work. But Sarah, I read in Wikipedia that you originally intended to be a poet and not a playwright. What happened?
What happened was I met an extraordinary teacher at the right time in my life, and that was Paula Vogel. And I met her at Brown, and she kind of pulled me over from poetry into the dark side of playwriting. It made sense because I was around the theater all my life. My mom was an actress, so in a way, it was like marrying poetry to this more muscular thing that was in my childhood. And when I first started writing plays, it seemed too fun. Like, how could you possibly do this for a life?
As opposed to poetry. Which was no fun at all.
Which was solitary.
Oh, I see, yeah.
But it's funny. I think if I had met a poetry teacher at that time in my life who said, I think you could do this for your life, I think I would just as well have done that.
But you could do both. One doesn't prohibit you from doing the other, does it?
That is an interesting question. I mean, but it's so rare to
see
people who actually keep doing both.
In fact, I can't even think of an example. I know poets that have written plays, but I can't think of primary playwrights who have written poetry. That maybe exposes my ignorance, but I can't think of any.
No, I mean, I think a couple have come out with slim volumes that were quite forgettable and, you know, not very good. I mean, my theory is that actually bad poetry makes good plays.
Really? Why do you suppose?
Because I think there's something cruder about the form of playwriting. It has to be oral. You have to hear it once and get it.
You can't allow for too much verbal density.
You can't. I mean, it's funny. It's a literary form in a way, and in another way, it's really not a literary form. It kind of hovers between the two. I think if you put bad poetry into the mouth of characters, it becomes funny. It becomes another thing. There's a valence around it that you don't get if you just have bad poetry on a page.
Huh. I have never heard that theory. So when did you develop an interest in Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop? And you don't have to say this, but I really want to know, who do you like better?
I'll tell you.
Okay.
Well, I was on bed rest when I was pregnant with twins. And friends would recommend books because I was dying of boredom. And my good friend Kathleen Tolan, who's also a playwright, gave me this book, knowing that I loved Elizabeth Bishop. And I just could not put it down. I was so arrested by it and taken with it. And I came to it loving Bishop and not actually knowing much of Lowell. And so I sort of came to love Lowell through his prose and then finding out more about his poetry.
The letters are super lively, and they put us all to shame, frankly, that in our email, in our texting and emailing culture, that these guys would whip off these brilliant letters without a great deal of thought. One gets the feeling.
I wonder. I mean, part of me thinks they did give it a great deal of thought, because there's something, at the time that they met, he'd already won the Pulitzer, and she was an established poet to some degree. And I feel like they knew on some level that they'd be published. So in some ways, they feel
posterity was looking over their shoulder when they were writing these.
I wonder. I mean, they have a wonderful spontaneity and intimacy, but they also sometimes have the quality of a performance, which is why I thought they might make a good stage play.
Yeah. So give us a sketch of their friendship, which was mostly in letters, but not always. Give us a sense of its arc.
Well, she sends him the first letter congratulating him on 3 awards. And it cracks me up because I think it was the Guggenheim, the Pulitzer, and the, was it the National
Book Award?
Book Award.
And probably. she says, same year?
Yeah. And she says very dryly, I guess I'll just call them 1, 2, and 3. It's like a wonderful, lovely, minimalist letter.
Yeah.
And then he writes back saying, your note was the only one that meant anything to me.
Because he already knew her work and admired her.
Yes. And then he writes a review of her poems, and she's very moved by it because she feels he's the first person to find any general drift or consistency in the poems. And then he invites her to Washington to record her poems.
Mm-hmm.
And they meet. And then they just keep meeting in different places. And there's an extraordinary time they spend in Maine together that they keep referring to, alluding to, but you never quite know what happened.
Yeah, what do you think did happen? It comes up in your play that they allude to it, and we don't see, because of course in your play, I haven't seen it, I've only read it, but in your play they are basically reading the letters as if it's almost dialogue. But they refer to this incident in Maine. Something untoward happened, but we don't know what.
Well, he broke up with his then-girlfriend when visiting Elizabeth Bishop in Maine. And so it was kind of this crazy weekend where his girlfriend was there. He broke up with her. She fled. I think this was Carly Dawson. And then they had some metaphysical, transcendent something moment in the water together. He writes a poem about it called Water.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives it to her much later. And she also reminisces about that day, about being knee-deep in the water with him and him looking like Saint Sebastian. And later, after that weekend, something changes in their letters and they become more flirtatious. And one senses that they sort of fell in love
mm-hmm.
that weekend, but it's never spoken. And of course, she was a lesbian.
Did she know she was a lesbian at the time? Because she mentions that she was kind of looking for a husband as well.
Yes, she dated men also. I mean, she had dated a man who killed himself when she was in college.
Hmm.
I don't think she was sort of actively dating men when she met Robert Lowell. She was actively dating women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so hard to tell because at that time, I mean, it was so different.
I mean,
she was very much, I think, in certain ways in the closet. And she talks about her lover and the great love of her life to Robert Lowell, but never did she mention the word lesbian anywhere in the letters.
Yeah. Although it's acknowledged when she eventually moves to Brazil and she has a long-term mm-hmm. lover in Brazil named Lota. And Robert Lowell acknowledges the fact that they're a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a romantic element to it, but it also had a deep level of friendship to it.
Mm-hmm.
These people admired each other mm-hmm. deeply.
They were these amazing, astonishing minds. And I think they were the only people, to some extent, that they could fully share the full contents of their literary minds with.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Robert Lowell had more society, and Bishop was always in another continent. And I think didn't talk about her work with many people but Lowell. I think he was kind of a lifeline for her.
And so much of the relationship did take place in letters, which is kind of appropriate because these are people who enacted their personalities in words as poets. And also, they seemed in some level to be comfortable with a literary or epistolatory relationship.
Right? I think so. In some ways, I think it's the only way their relationship could have duration because she had her troubles, he had his troubles.
Mm-hmm.
She talks to friends about how she had always regretted not having a child in general and at one point says she wished she'd had a child with Robert Lowell,
oh.
but she feared his madness.
He was manic depressive and frequently hospitalized and
yeah.
an alcoholic as well.
Yeah, and she was an alcoholic and a depressive.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll go to the sanitarium and she would have rest cures in Brazil and they would allude to these moments, these bleak periods, and then they would carry on with their friendship. But if they had been in the same place, one wonders if the friendship would have been too combustible.
Yeah. But you've written the play, or not written the play, you've arranged the letters into a play that is very much in the form of a romance. They love each other. And it's not unrequited love either. They palpably love each other. It's just not a fully realized love.
It's an impossible love. And I guess I'm attracted to impossible love stories.
Mm.
I mean, the first act, in a way, I structured, I think the way the letters are structured, where it's almost a natural form of a romantic comedy where you wonder if these two people will end up together. And then you realize, no, they won't. And so I think the second act becomes about something else altogether and leaves that form behind. And you sort of realize she's going to be with women. He's going to be with a series of women.
Mm.
And then it becomes more about their lives unfolding and what they can share with each other.
Mm-hmm. One of Lowell's most famous poems, and it's in your play, it's called Skunk Hour. And we're going to listen to Robert Lowell reading this poem. But what do you think would be good to know beforehand?
Well, he wrote it for Bishop. And he says at one point in the letters, a skunk isn't much of a present for a lady poet, but I'm the skunk in the poem.
He's the skunk in the poem.
He says it very directly to her.
Uh-huh.
And then in some ways, I think she wrote Armadillo for him to answer Skunk Hour.
They both wrote
these creature poems to each other. And I always found it very moving that he carried Armadillo around in his pocket or in his wallet. It's as though they carried each other's poems in their pockets to remind each other what a poem could be.
Yeah. The poem starts out by describing an eccentric, wealthy old woman in a town on the coast of Maine, and then it goes into the troubled state of mind of the speaker. Here's Robert Lowell reading Skunk Hour.
Nautilus Island's hermit heiress still lives through winter in her Spartan cottage. Her sheep still graze above the sea. Her son's a bishop. Her farmer is first selectman in our village. She's in her dotage, thirsting for the hierarchic privacy of Queen Victoria's century. She buys up all the eyesores facing her shore and lets them fall. The season's ill. We've lost our summer millionaire who seemed to leap from an L.L. Bean catalog. His nine-knot yawl was auctioned off to lobstermen. A red fox stain covers Blue Hill. And now our fairy decorator brightens his shop for fall, his fish nets filled with orange cork, orange is cobbler's bench and all. There is no money in his work, he'd rather marry. One dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill skull. I watched for love cars. Lights turned down, they lay together hull to hull where the graveyard shelves on the town. My mind's not right. A car radio bleats, love, oh careless love. I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks that search in the moonlight for a bite to eat. They march on their souls up Main Street. White stripes, moon-struck eyes, red fire, under the chalk, dry and spire of the Trinitarian Church. I stand on top of our back steps and breathe the rich air. A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. She jabs her wedge head in a cup of sour cream, drops her ostrich tail, and will not scare.
Now, a lot of people like that poem. It's a famous poem, and it's thought to be among Robert Lowell's best. But tell me what you like about it. Why did you put this in your play?
The most obvious reason I put it in the play is that he wrote it for her.
Mm-hmm.
And funnily, the poems that Lowell wrote for Bishop seem a little bit infected with Bishop, with her sparseness.
And her precision of detail.
Yes. There's a little bit of a metaphysical, hermetic quality to it, where the animal, to me, becomes its own mystery. I mean, we know it's Robert Lowell, but it has a fable quality.
Uh-huh.
Some of Lowell's other poems feel more confessional in a more direct way. And this, I feel, has some of Bishop's refraction and restraint.
Yeah, Bishop didn't love confessionalism. She didn't like the, you know, showing your laundry type stuff.
She hated it.
And Robert Lowell, of course, showed a lot of his dirty laundry. In this poem, he does not. It's refracted through precise observation and the skunk, and what the skunk means. What does that skunk mean? What does that skunk, if Robert Lowell is the skunk, what is it saying about Robert Lowell?
I mean, it's fascinating. I hesitate to comment on it in a way because it is sort of irreducible.
Mm.
He also is present in the poem.
I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks that search in the moonlight for a bite to eat.
So he's watching. I mean, he's looking for food. He's trying to survive. I mean, there's something about the mother skunk up against life's degradations and deprivations.
I stand on top of our back steps and breathe the rich air. A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. She jabs her wedge head in a cup of sour cream, drops her ostrich tail, and will not scare.
I find that line very moving somehow, and will not scare.
Yeah, that's a tremendous ending to it. So why do you think Robert Lowell dedicated Skunk Hour to Elizabeth Bishop?
It's hard to say, but he says to her, "I'm dedicating Skunk Hour to you. I feel that I write only for you and Lizzie," his wife, Elizabeth Hardwick.
Yeah, the short story writer, yeah.
And then he says, "We've talked over a lot of things together I've never mentioned to Elizabeth. If you ever feel like writing me privately, I don't mean anything by this. You can address the letter to the Department of English at Boston University."
What did he mean by that?
Well, one doesn't know. I mean, that's what I love about the letters, is these kind of glorious omissions. It seems like Skunk Hour was, in a way, an invitation to a greater intimacy. He was showing her a deep, troubled, private part of himself.
Yeah.
She, in response, says, "Oh, I found it very hard to write to you. I don't often have these letter-writing blocks, and particularly about my favorite correspondence." She later says, "My idea," she sends him some Purcell, and she says, "My idea is to wean you away from those French songs because the English ones are so much better and so much more appropriate to us," which I think she means, you know, English decorum and not French
lasciviousness.
Yes, I think. I think she's very indirect about it, but I think that's what she means. And then she says, "I'd be particularly charmed to have Skunk Hour dedicated to me." So she frames her pleasure in the dedication up against a certain amount of pushing back and restraint.
Yeah.
"Thanks for the poem. I like the poem, but don't get any ideas."
Yeah.
"I'm not writing you at a private address."
Because apparently in the past he did overstep some bounds and made them both uncomfortable. And it's unclear exactly what he did, but it probably involved alcohol.
Yes. I mean, there's one incident where they visited and he somehow got too close. One doesn't know if he tried to embrace her or if he was forward with her or if he was having a manic episode or what happened. But he has this incredible letter where he apologizes for overstepping his boundaries and promises never to do it again.
We've all written that letter.
And that was sort of that to me was the letter that I found so beautiful and kind of one for the ages that I felt like I had to write a play about it.
That letter in particular.
That letter. I can read a little bit from that
if you
want. Yeah,
please do. Go ahead. Yeah.
"Let me say this, though, and then leave the matter forever. I do think free will is sewn into everything we do. You can't cross the street, light a cigarette, drop saccharin in your coffee without really doing it. Yet the possible alternatives that life allows us are very few. Often there must be none. I've never thought there was any choice for me about writing poetry. No doubt if I'd used my head better, ordered my life better, worked harder, the poetry would be improved, and there must be many lost poems, innumerable accidents and ill-done actions. But asking you is the might have been for me, the one towering change, the other life that might have been had." So he's in the letter, he describes a moment where he thought about asking her to marry him and then didn't.
Put it off. The opportunity never came back.
Yeah.
And it's now a deep regret with them. She probably would have said no anyway.
Probably.
She had enough sense to say no to Robert Lowell. So let's get to Elizabeth Bishop's poem. Another poem in your play is one of her most famous. It's the great Villanelle, One Art. Tell us a little bit about where that fits in her life. When did you write this?
Well, she actually writes it later chronologically, I believe, than I put it in the play, which is a little bit, I hope that's not misleading. Her big love, Loda, commits suicide very unexpectedly.
Mm-hmm.
She loses Loda. She loses her beloved house in Brazil that she shared with Loda.
Mm-hmm.
And then she goes on to have two more relationships, one of which, again, ends really badly. And she writes this poem, I believe, after that breakup.
Go ahead and read it. This is One Art by Elizabeth Bishop.
"The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I own, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master. Though it may look like, write it like disaster.
What a terrific poem.
I love that poem.
Yeah. Even outside, it's touching within the context of her losing a lover. But it's a much bigger poem than that, because we're all ultimately losers, and she points that out very clearly. We will all lose everything that we have. And there's a sort of a casualness that even in an extreme form like the Villanelle, which is one of the tightest forms that you could write in, even in that poem, you hear a sort of an offhand casualness when she says, look.
Oh, look.
Oh, look. there's an offhandedness and a
well, there's an
and a
in,
humor.
There's an in-the-momentness about it, as though she's interrupted in the act of writing by a thought, oh, look, or write it. So it's as though you're sitting with her in the writing process, even though we know that the writing process was arduous and that she went through draft upon draft of that poem.
Yeah.
It feels like you're watching her compose it.
In your play, you gave that write it line, and the very last line when there's M dashes in the poem and it says write it, as if this is a hard conclusion to get to. You gave that line to Robert Lowell,
mm-hmm.
as if he's in the background and she's listening to his advice.
Well, I love how they spur each other on to write. I mean, particularly she had more issues with long silences, and so he was always saying, finish the poem, finish the poem.
Mm. One last question is, before we started talking, you said you got in arguments with somebody about this poem and made that person cry.
Yes, I felt so terrible. I was at a sweet little brunch where we were supposed to each bring a poem and read it.
Uh-huh.
And I read this one. And a woman started attacking the poem.
Really?
And saying that she found it very glib about loss. I said, well, excuse me, but I don't think it's glib at all. I think it has some really biting irony about attachment and loss, but it is not glib. And she thought it was written from the point of view of someone who hadn't lost anything. And then I realized in the course of this heated argument about poetry that this woman had just lost someone very dear to her. And then I felt terrible that I'd gone after her. And then she started crying. And I thought, what is wrong with me that I felt so passionately that I had to defend Elizabeth Bishop against misinterpretation by someone who had just lost someone very...
you didn't know.
I didn't know, to be fair.
Yeah. A lot of people just don't pick up on irony at all.
True enough.
And the irony in Elizabeth Bishop is often in the tone, basically buried in her tone of voice.
Yes. And she's kind of a master of deadpan, which I think is pretty rare for a poet and might be one reason why I'm so in love with her.
Sarah Rule, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Rule's play, Dear Elizabeth, is playing at the Berkeley Rep until July 7th. You can read a print interview with her about the play by Ruth Graham on our website. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.